coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored
hey buddy, give
to
me
dimensions.
Just a second. The intro's flying right now.
Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody. How you doing this Tuesday evening? Chris Jordan coming at you from Austin, Texas. Oh, man. I tell you, sometimes the world is the world and life is life, and there's nothing you can do but duck and dodge and dive from the artillery fire, man. Hope everybody is doing well tonight. I have some friends out there that I'm praying hard for right now. They know who they are. If you have some energy, just pray for my friends who need praying for. I don't want to air their things personally on air, but they definitely need some vibes out there, as does a lot of the world. We unfortunately were unable to connect with our first guest this evening. We were supposed to have the medium Brooke Ashley on to talk about spiritual connection with the other side, things like that. So in lieu of Brooke Ashley, we have the always indomitable and stalwart Mike Turber, who literally got a phone call like a minute and a half before we went live. Welcome back to the show as always, Mike Turber. How are you, my friend?
Hey, bud, I'm hanging in there. Yeah, always on call for the emergency guest if you need it.
You are more than just a guest. You are a friend of friends, dude. We have shared so many conversations on the side about things. And, you know, it's been fascinating to me over the last year, some of the things that we have covered. Tonight I want to get into, it dawned on me as I called you. And I was like, what the hell am I going to talk to Mike Turber about if I call him?
still don't know.
yeah, right? He still doesn't know. I just figured it out like 2 minutes ago, a minute and a half. Like I called him a minute and a half ago. 30 seconds after that is the intro aired. I was like, I have it. We have never covered the Route 91 shooting updates, Michael. It's never happened.
Okay.
And that's quite that's literally true. The beginnings of, I mean, that happened, the anniversary just passed at the beginning of October, and that is quite literally what begat our friendship, not only as host guest, but off air as well, due to our good friend out there, Shannon Ray Caffey. If you're listening, kudos to you, my friend. I hope things are well. I hope you're blessed with your wife as y'all travel across the country and you're living your best RV life.
I love getting those pictures from him.
I know, he's, man.
He's great.
He is just out loving all of it. And I love that. I love that for them because it really was for them and a few people that I know that were working the concert that night, Mike. It was a life-changing moment. Something that, I mean, and for those of you that aren't aware, the Route 91 shooting is the Vegas shooting, the Mandalay Bay massacre, as it's supposedly called, all kinds of things. But
now, I think it's also called 1 October is how the official agencies and whatever they call it 1 October. But in my mind, just like yours, it's the Route 91 concert.
Well, and it's also, not a lot of people realize it, but it is America's largest mass shooting. It was covered up, swept under the rug, back to business as usual, as fast as possible.
It had so many aspects of it that were not seen in other. I mean, it was like a new chapter for a book of describing, common characteristics of mass shootings, and this one just broke that mold completely.
Yeah,
it was not like any other any other shooting by any stretch of the imagination, that just by the sheer numbers, all of the conspiracy stories that came out of it, that, some of them had some bite and some of them didn't. And then, when you look at the effect it had, but it is Vegas, and Vegas has a way of getting business back to normal a little quicker than, say, some other cities. And in doing so, it created some other issues and a lot of questions that were not getting answered by the mainstream media. So smaller outlets like myself and some others were literally on the streets trying to get answers to the questions that were being asked. Some, were able to do that. Some not so much. But overall, I think that one, that event, certainly changed my life. I know it changed a lot of people's lives, but you have to speak from your own personal experience. And for me, it changed it in a completely new direction. And, it's been an interesting experience, but at the same time, when you look back to what occurred and the people that were affected, the sheer number is just overwhelming. But a lot of really amazing friendships came out of it. And wherever there's evil, there's also ways to find good. And I think that's what I pull away from it as best I can. It's an experience that I wouldn't want to go through again. I don't think anybody ever would want to go through something like that. Yeah. But having been through it, I would not change too many of the things that I personally did to try to get answers for questions. But it still reigns as the largest mass shooting in the United States history. It's hard to pull away from it with all the effects it's had. It's a deep one. It's a deep wound.
It is. And, you and Ram Dennison did an amazing documentary with Money Machine. And you guys, before that even happened, you did some amazing investigative work into not only the shooting, but the location, the fact that, and you had reported long, long before they made it official that the body had been moved.
Yes.
By police, all kinds of things. So let's start breaking some of that stuff down real quick. I mean, to the point that you were actively banned from Wynn properties because of going up the secret elevator in the back of the hotel, or at least going to the private floor in the elevator.
The back of house. I had a wind something in me just said, this is what you want to do. I mean, I've done so many different types of, I don't want to say career choices, but I've basically created businesses in areas that I thought I would like a lot more than I actually did when I got into it.
Yeah.
But then when I started, cause I was always doing these investigations left and right, kind of on the side, so to speak, for some, and for others, it was more straightforward. But in working, not being in law enforcement, you don't have the actual access to some of the evidence. So it makes it a lot more difficult to try to determine what has happened or occurred at a scene, even though you have a lot of forensic experience and what have you, but you don't have access to the evidence. So you pretty much have a lot of access to the same evidence that mainstream media has, and you have to decipher that. That's what Money Machine shows. It shows some of the things that we had to do to determine what actually happened. So some of the key things that were being asked by the attorneys, which was truly the main motivator I started having, was what the attorneys were asking and what the victims or the victims' families and the survivors were asking, were certain questions that law enforcement was not giving them the answer and didn't seem like they would ever probably get those answers. A classic example was the first one, probably the one that seemed to get me on the map, so to speak. was how did he get those weapons to the room, and how was he able to get on that service elevator and so forth. And so that's the one that kind of, put me in front of the pack, I guess, on some of that. But, they had hired several investigators to try to figure this out. And then, I came up with, with a way to do that. And I did it 57 times. I went in and no one has ever stopped me. I was never questioned, nothing. And I have a gift of doing that due to my penetration testing, whether physical penetration testing, which is a way that we go into a facility to determine how strong the security measures are, or if it's a cyber threat as well. Yeah. So pen testing is both, physical and also, going through the cyber door. Mm-hmm. But, doing that with the going up the elevators, we, on the 27th trip or 26th trip, I took Laura Loomer. We got that video that we did together on Fox News. And, it created some other questions. But the thing was is that when you brought up the wind thing earlier, I kind of laugh every time that comes up. Steve Wynn, the guy that basically created Vegas, was on a Sunday morning show. And it was on, I believe it was on Fox. And he basically stated that during the questioning that no one had ever been on the service elevator at a Wynn facility without security. And he had just bragged about they had spent $26 million revamping their security. They had, Chris from SEAL Team 6. They had a whole bunch of different things they've done. It took them over a year to do it. To prevent such a thing from happening. And when he specifically stated no one had ever been on the service elevator there, that was the first time that anyone had heard that Paddock had probably taken the service elevator. So it was kind of like a leak of information. But I immediately left and went over to the Wynn and decided, well, I have no idea what I'm doing or where I'm going to go, but I'm going to try to figure out how to get into the service elevator. And I didn't just get on one of the service elevators. I got on all five. And when I left, I told the security there what had just happened, what I had done, and gave a card to them. I said, have your head of security contact me, and we can talk about this and see how we can help you. And they were mad. The head of security, or it was a female, and she called and she basically told me that I was banned from their facilities for life. And I even said, I tried to offer to tell them how it was done and what have you, but they were a little bit upset about that. Well, I get it. I get it.
And you know what's funny? I work in the events industry, things like that. I walk the back hallways of hotels all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. And it's a funny thing when you think about it because, when you're talking stop infiltration in that kind of way, specifically mm-hmm. social engineering in that kind of way, where it's like, hey, if you're seen around and that kind of stuff, if you're a familiar face or your face looks like a familiar face, or amiable, like feel free to make eye contact. That makes people uncomfortable. And that's just it. Most average people are not willing to confront somebody in the back hallway saying, hey, you don't look like you belong here.
Well, the thing is once you're back there, what I've noticed is that a lot of people just assume if you're already there, then you've passed whatever security protocol they have.
Yeah.
And you have a reason to be there. Especially if you have to walk in like you own it. If you walk out of the elevator, you don't like lean your head out and look both ways and kind of like poke around a corner or something like that. Just walk out. And the funny thing is in the video that I did on doing the Wynn was one of the elevators I walked out of went straight into the back of their main kitchen.
Oh, wow.
And I had already committed. I had already committed to going into walking out and just exploring where I could go.
Yeah.
And And I walked into the back of this kitchen, and I, you know, the chefs were looking at me, and I was kind of like a little taken aback. But I looked around, and right when I got out the elevator, I had seen some French bowl, you know, French onion soup type bowls that, you know, you melt the cheese on top of and what have you. I don't know if there's a certain name for them. And the chef, he looked at me, and he says, can I help you? I said, yeah, I just want to make certain that you got the bowl cups. And he goes, bowl cups? Yeah, the bowl cups. They're for the French onion soup. And he goes, oh, yeah, they came in there over here. I said, oh, yeah, they are. Okay, great. All right, well, thank you. Have a good night. And I walked back into the elevator. Oh, man, I couldn't believe it. You know, that was the funniest, but also a scary moment for me, because I thought, well, this is going to be ruined right here. Someone's going to be chasing me around the back halls of the Wynn Casino. You know, it is it's like trying to be the Frank Abagnale. I don't know if, you know, catch me if you can.
Yep.
Yeah. Trying to do that. I did meet him a couple times, and, it's interesting in some of his stories, and some of the stories over the years that I've had are, you know, somewhat similar. Some of the things you have to do, they have to be well-rounded in several different subject fields to be able to, you know, get into, you know, several situations or get yourself out of several situations, as you try to get in and capture the flag, so to speak. That's what we kind of jokingly call it. This penetration testing, you generally have a goal to get to. And once you get there, it's basically you grab the flag just like in a video game.
Yeah.
And, you come out and show them that you got it. That's one aspect of it. There's a couple of things that, you know, to update the listeners on some of the things that occurred that were a little interesting. Just to recap, the shooting occurred, and the investigation that occurred by the Las Vegas Metro Police, that was Sheriff Lombardo, and also with the FBI, when you go back to it, that was an election year. So you had, Sheriff Lombardo was running again for sheriff, and that created a series of events that most of the public is not very aware of. And the sheriff's department was to, or Las Vegas Metro Police was supposed to release all of their, video, their, you know, basically everything like a FOIA request would have. And they were holding it back, saying that it was going to cost, you know, $500,000 and all these different things, and just reason after reason to hold back to doing it. But you have to. That's what the law is. And as they were finally admonished in the courts, in the Supreme Court of California, of Nevada, basically told them to begin releasing, they started releasing it in an odd order. It wasn't chronologically. They didn't. You know, it was like, okay, we got a batch. The first day we got four videos and some other stuff. And then it came out in these little chunks. Every Wednesday at 10 o'clock, we had to be down there and grab the CD and head back and then try to decipher what we're looking at. Because there's nothing really that came with it. It's just a redacted, you know, body worn camera video, which, you know, that was, you know, as far as the public's eye, that was what we saw, and that's what is we remember. But as an investigator, we try to piece together the story that we're being told by all of the video and audio that's coming out as to what happened. So we're trying to rebuild those moments. They had their narrative, which was obviously being questioned in the beginning about the time that Jesus Campos made it to the room. Did he go up this elevator, down the elevator? Was he on the 31st floor? Was he on the 33rd floor, which is in between the 32nd floor, where Paddock was? So there's all these different questions that we were trying to get answers to that we felt that some of that video would give, but we weren't receiving it in order. One of the key videos that we didn't get until after the election, which really keyed in on a problem, was when I think it was Officer Meeks, memory serves on his name, because this was that moment. I don't remember exactly, but he was an officer that was on the 31st floor, just below the floor of the shooting, and he was a training officer. So he had another officer with him that was being trained, and he froze. He literally had a moment where he was in a doorway. You had this security from Mandalay Bay, which is the MGM security there, and he froze in that doorway, and he had an opportunity, it can be argued back and forth, to get to that room quickly and probably prevent some of the, I don't want to use the word carnage, but for lack of a better term, it's the only thing that came to mind, that was happening outside. And in training for this type of an event, after a couple other events occurred, they changed how they approach mass shooting events of this nature. Is you go directly to the shooter and stop it, regardless. And that's what, and he's a training officer, so he should have known this, but he did freeze. That was a key point that we felt that, okay, this is kind of proof that they have withheld other information as well till after the election. Another case in point was we were told that Officer Levi Hancock, who was the first officer through the door when they breached the door into Paddock's room. He was the first officer through the door. And we were told that he did not have his body-worn camera, that he had not kept it.
Yep.
Well, he did. That video was just released about 2.5 months ago, well after, we're talking years after the time it was supposed to be released. We were never even told that it even existed. Our mutual friends, you remember WEGO and LVSA, Las Vegas. I can't say his real name on the air because he doesn't want that done. But, he did some incredible work and he did a FOIA request and got that video. So we now have the Levi Hancock video. It tells a whole nother story about what happened, but I know you and I have been to Vegas many, many times, and Vegas did change a little bit after that, but I think in some ways, and I hate to say it, but I think security ramps up a little bit, but then it goes back to business as usual. And that for me is, I have a problem with that. I think once you put some certain security protocols, not too much to where you're invasive in place, that there are ways to keep the public safe, especially in a public event, could be looked at. We learn from each of these events, and sometimes we don't learn from each of these events, and that's where we need to be a little bit more vigilant and understanding of why these things occur and how to prevent them in the future.
I will definitely say that I've seen more so because, I do go a few times a year, not as much as I once did whenever we first met. Like, I was in Vegas 10, 12 weeks a year for work, and now I'm there about 4 weeks, something like that. But even at the various properties that I stay at while I'm there, I've noticed a difference in the way that security is handled going up the elevators and getting to your room. And in addition to that, I've also noticed the fact that there seems to be at least more presence in back hallways of security than there ever was before, and that's a good thing. That's a plus. It was interesting whenever you guys did the documentary to mm-hmm. a talk to Stephen Paddock, because y'all were basically the only ones that got exclusive interviews with him, things like that.
With Eric Paddock, yeah.
Eric Paddock, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That came about in an odd way, but it is how I tend to do. Whenever I do an investigation, I try to get as close to the source of information that would be most, you know, detrimental or the, you know, whatever it is to, for the case to get the answers of the people that are asking me to do it.
Yeah.
Normally it's attorneys or it's a family that needs answers as to why something happened and so forth. And these are sad, tragic events. I normally do, you know, very high profile, cases and you know, you do some medium profiles as well. But in between those, you start to learn that there's a certain way to get to, the person that has what you need, as far as, and 9 times out of 10, it's just information. And in this case, it was, you know, I felt that Stephen Paddock's brother, Eric, was going to be the best source of information, but he was very elusive. There was only the interviews he did the day, day of and the day after the shooting. That was it. He didn't do any interviews. He didn't want to talk to anyone or what have you. But I had called and left a couple of messages, and I guess one of the messages, you know, made sense to him. And, he called me back and he says, you know, why should I be talking to you? And we had a talk, and I talked to him for about an hour, you know, and he saw that, I guess, I was in it for the right reasons. I charged nobody a dime for the investigative services that I did. And I just felt like it was important. And he was on board, you know, and, he gave information that, you know, that explained exactly what happened. We had the motive, which is the most elusive thing that the media kept placing on this particular event, was the motive was missing. They couldn't figure out why he did it. 64-year-old man seemed to be relatively successful. Had a girlfriend, loved going to Vegas, blah, 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 this and that. You know, why would he do this? You know, he didn't have a note that he left behind. There was no manifesto of any sort. Nothing that would be an indicator as to why it happened. And that was one of the first, areas I explored with Eric. And, we have since become, you know, pretty good friends. And, in talking to him, you know, it's kind of weird because when you're with him, you have the presence, because it looks very similar to his brother. And so it creates a whole nother aura of a conversation. But that's kind of like a private thing, I guess, but I just wanted to make it public, because it can explain some of the things that you go through as an investigator, where you're trying to get to the crux of the situation, you're trying to get down into the meat of it and find out, you know, why this happened. And the motive was it. The FBI couldn't figure it out. They had the behavioral analysis unit, the BAU, come in and do something with 25 different experts they hired from outside. And they came up with the basically same conclusion that we did, you know, 2 years prior. That was a whole nother event. If you remember correctly, when they did reveal what the motive was, and I can do that as well if you need to.
Please.
Whenever you receive a report from any agency, about a event such as this, you're expecting to see a large, report. You know, the Las Vegas Metro, they had, you know, their report that they came out with, that was fairly well done. There was some, you know, quite a few errors in it, but, you know, they came out with a preliminary report, and then they had their final report. But they couldn't put the motive together. And all of these reports that come out, you generally expect to see a rather large report. The BAU, their report was 2.5 pages. That was it. And it read like a top 10 list as to, you know, why this happened. And it, had that air of a, like a late night TV show, top 10 reasons why this event occurred of thing. And that was it. And that was the 2.5 pages. It was just, you know, each little aspect of it, which kind of mirrored what Eric and I had determined previously, which was you had a man who was 64 years old, obviously had some issue, which is never determined to be, you know, diagnosed or anything as far as him having a true a mental issue. But he had an issue. And his experience was in going to casinos, he got into a pattern where he was doing quite well. He wasn't like a super big hitter, but he was in the upper echelon of where they would be. And they started changing his reward. They did it in Reno, when he was, you know, the larger fish in Reno because it was a much, you know, smaller pond. But as this came back, it created a whole new scenario, and he would have his points taken away, or he wouldn't make as many points, or what have you, because, you know, the casino just kind of changed the game. And that happened in Reno, and so he switched to Vegas, and it started happening there. So that was an aspect. He was also, his passion was flying. And so he enjoyed, you know, having his plane and taking it and, you know, going wherever he wanted to go with his family or whatever. And once he was diagnosed with high blood pressure, the medication that was given to him, was medication that he could not handle. It created more issues. Let's just put it that way. And in doing so, since he couldn't take that, then that meant that he couldn't pass his flight physical for the FAA. And that created another issue where they removed his license from him. So he couldn't fly. The other problems with the medication is that he couldn't, we'll just say perform in the bedroom, to the degree that he once could. So that created that issue. And so it was just one thing after another, just the main things that were giving him drive to do whatever he wanted to do, were being taken away from him. And, you know, the average person may get through it in their own way. They certainly, you don't go out and do what he did.
Yeah.
But for him, he wanted to get back at the gaming community, for creating the series of events that he felt that, affected him. And he, you know, he had done well, but he had lost quite a bit of money, you know, in the 2 years leading up to this. But he was still quite well off. I mean, he had plenty to carry on. There was even a $33,000, you know, slot machine or that, you know, ticket that because he played video poker. So they, you know, produced like, just like slot machines, a ticket that was in his room that was part of the inventory. So he was doing well, and he gambled over $1 million the week that led up to the shooting. But the way it was carried out was unlike anything anyone had ever seen. There was just, you know, it's difficult enough to try to profile and determine if that person coming through your door that's running a room is going to be the next, Las Vegas shooter, or if it's going to be, you know, your average guy. And so some people, you know, there is no 100% ironclad way to determine that, but there are some measures to put in place that won't be invasive, and won't really change the customer's overall experience at their facilities. But they need to be done. And unfortunately, we still have a very high rate of mass shooting events, and, we haven't found the, we found a couple of answers, but implementing them across the board is another thing, because our country enjoys its freedoms. our Second Amendment is obviously key. And, you know, that's not going to go anywhere anytime soon. I don't expect it to. And me personally, I don't want it to.
The whole bump stock situation came and lawsuits that came after that for bump stock and everything else came from this.
Because it did.
Bump stocks in the shooting.
Yeah. And that's also where a lot of people, you know, thought that it was fully automatic gunfire, but, you know, technically it wasn't. But it may as well have been, because it fired at a very similar rate to like a Saw 240 or something. But the bump stock, the creator of the bump stock, he was sued. And they ended up, the Supreme Court basically banned that device, like they had done many before that. There's been many devices that basically convert your average, I don't want to say average, because for some people, an AR-15 is not average, but you take an AR-15 and you add a device to it, and it essentially creates what becomes a fully automatic weapon, or that gives you the feel of the sense of that it's a fully automatic weapon, when in fact, you know, you still have to pull the trigger and you still have to do other things to make it function in a way that causes it to seem like automatic.
Yeah.
And you also lose your accuracy. You know, you're not going to be super accurate with the bump stock.
Yeah.
The problem is that he had the advantage of elevation on the 32nd floor. He was aiming down into a concert, which had been reported to have 22,000 people on it at that event. But that evening was around 10 or maybe 12,000, because it was close to the end. And it was, you know, the third day and it was Sunday night and so forth. But the, you know, from that advantage, you know, using those weapons, and instead of changing out clips, which would, create another issue of possibly him jamming the weapon, he just would grab another weapon. He had 23 with him in the room. That's a lot. So, and he was able to expend over 1,100 rounds. You know, he injured over 800 some odd people, 400 directly with weapon fire, and some indirectly by the, you know, by the events that occurred after the weapon fired. You know, you had 58 people that died that night. You had two more that has died since then due to some various complications. I don't want to get into the details of it because it's private for the individuals. But, you know, they succumbed to this event as well. So it's the number is 60, because, you know, everybody wants to know how many. But it was 58 and then became 60. So we don't ever want to see something like that again. And it's there's no contest here for someone to have the highest amount, but I'm happy that it has not occurred.
But again, in any mass shooting scenario, you'll hear Uvalde, you'll hear Florida, you'll still hear Columbine, and Sandy Hook, all kinds of things. You don't hear Route 91. You don't hear one October. You don't hear it. No. It is the forgotten and the unsung. Nobody talks about it. And it is literally the largest mass shooter. Once again, 60 people ultimately dead from the actions just of him. Just of him. And that doesn't include the other people that were injured due to trampling, all kinds of things, shrapnel. And let's get into some of the, because the theories and hypotheses were wild out there. And I have them out there too. Feel free to go listen to Dudes and Beer, folks. But I remember my hypothesis of, he was at one point an accountant at Lockheed Martin. And had flown on Janet planes, things like that. So it was like, hey, what if he was part of the disclosure movement and had seen things and wanted to release it, you know, wanted to come clean, so to speak.
And there was quite a few scenarios that were put out, and part of the reason that there were so many different I hate using the term conspiracy theories, but that is the term.
They were.
There's so many conspiracy theories that were being brought forward because, you know, MGM was controlling the narrative. They weren't letting information come out. And so if people, you know, don't
the police kept changing timelines like every other day.
Yep. And he even, you know, to Lombardo's credit, he did say that would change. But the problem is, it's not that it was changing. It's who was causing the change and who was basically in control at that point. It wasn't the sheriff's department. It was clearly MGM was managing that timeline. The only video that exists outside of Mandalay Bay or MGM, as far as the shooting is concerned, that CCTV footage is the footage that I acquired. And that, that footage, which unfortunately shows the demise of an individual, a female. Her name is Melissa Ramirez. I don't want to say her name because she needs to be honored. But the scenario that played out that allowed me to get that video was an exact situation that, since we weren't getting information, no one was releasing anything. We had to start looking for it ourselves. I literally was looking for evidence as if I was working inside the FBI or working inside any agency or Las Vegas Metro, and I was going in places to see what I could find out. Going up and down the elevators, that was a question that the attorneys had. The attorney they had, that was Craig Island, and he used to be a senator in Texas, and he was on Fox, and he says, "We want to know how he got the weapons to the room." Okay, here's your answer. So I contacted them and let them know, hey, here's video of me doing the actual going up and down the service elevators and using the exact same one that used. I was never confronted. So that was an answer. The other, question was obtaining video of a very important part of this event that you spoke about, Janet Airlines, the camera that was actually pointing towards the two tanks that he had fired at, the two big fuel tanks, and also Janet Airlines is literally right behind it.
Yeah, and that was part of the reason of my hypothesis was that he's shooting directly in the area of the fuel tanks and actually hit one of the fuel tanks. That brought up a lot of stuff. The automatic gunfire, people saying that, especially the bump stock gunfire echoing inside of that cube of buildings, brought up numerous questions about multiple shooters. There was a shooter in the tunnel of the tram system going between properties. The Saudi royal family was involved. Mm-hmm. Like it got thick,
and they still think that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And, the ownership of the Four Seasons Hotel up top, because when people saw where the shooting was coming from, they assumed it was higher than it was, but it was it's just the 32nd floor. The Four Seasons starts higher than that. And also when the autopsy report came out and basically was identifying the wounds that these people were having, some being shot, what would seem to be vertical from a shot coming from the head through the torso and out, lower, they were being shot from overhead. And so the helicopter theory, which is probably the most predominant theory, and that's put forward by a person by the name of John Cullen, and me and him have had many rounds of a beef that we have had for years. It's quite comical to some degree, but it's also very serious at the other end. of putting out accurate information is very difficult to do when you have a lot of people that are knocking at your door saying, hey, you know, we've got proof that it was shot, you know, people were shot by helicopters. And when they looked at the proof, they don't look at it from a forensic standpoint, that a lot of people were bending over to try to avoid being shot. So naturally, yes, people would have the bullet entry wound come in possibly through the front. If your head's aimed towards the Mandalay Bay and your rear end's the other direction, then yeah, that's going to happen. And, you know, from all intents and purposes, when people visualize these things after they get a description of the wound, then yeah, it sounds like the person was shot from overhead. And so that, yeah, that fueled, you know, that theory. But, and then you had ninjas in the trees. And I mean, there was just so many. In fact, the entire algorithm of YouTube was changed, which destroyed my channel. But the YouTube was changed, the algorithm was changed on YouTube to address the concerns of the people that were being shown all these different conspiracy theories. It was just too much, you know, and so YouTube made the decision to just basically ban any information that had anything to do with the Las Vegas shooting, and they didn't have time to filter it to determine, you know, what the other events were, but that's what happened.
And you know, it's interesting. I just brought that up to somebody the other day. They made a post about how their Instagram was, or their TikTok rather, was banned.
Yep.
You know, and free speech was being canceled. And I was like, you know, the funny thing is, and they were putting a lot of stuff out about 3i Atlas, things like that. It's like, you know, there are some platforms that eventually the algorithm gets you when you are posting things that seem to be false against the actual against the actual science that's reported, things like that. Right. That was something that even happened on Google to alternative health sites and even like spiritual healers, things like that I know after COVID, because of the algorithms changing to get rid of medical disinformation. And they just, they said all like, no, I'm going to help heal you. You use the word heal. Algorithm caught you and it delisted your mediumship site, you know, where you give spiritual direction and spiritual healing.
Yeah, and it's extremely frustrating on a content creator's end.
Yeah,
and that you put a lot. They don't realize that there's a lot of time and effort that goes into doing these. I mean, in my case, you know, the investigative side was, you know, I wasn't reporting on what someone else had done. It's kind of odd, you know, kind of in a different category, I guess. And that not only was I reporting on what was happening, I was going to get the information, and in doing so, I actually became the story to some degree, and that, you know, allowed me to get, you know, as accurate of information as you can possibly get. So I felt like the information I was putting out, and to this day, I still feel, you know, it has been, you know, proven time and time again that the information was accurate. But YouTube decided to basically wipe the board of everybody, which, you know, took away those accounts. So there's a lot of, you know, some of the stuff that, you know, say 5% of the people that were affected, were, you know, probably legitimate, where 95% of the information that was coming out during the, you know, preliminary parts of the investigation in Las Vegas were essentially people just grasping at straws or making up their own stories, like the, like the helicopter theory and some of these other things that came out. But it also showed that there were some people that were trying to do these things, but they just were not necessarily in a position to determine, like, the audio of the things, you know, the weapons being shot and hearing the echoes and knowing that the echoes are echoes of the exact same shot that was just fired off of another building. And that created the sense of multiple shooters, which we talked about earlier. And that was probably the key conspiracy at the beginning of it, was that there were multiple shooters you know, he had him on top of those two towers that were across the street from Mandalay Bay. And, yep. You know, I decided, hey, I'm going to jump this fence and go in there, and I'm going to go inside and see if it's possible that someone could have done it from this location. And of course I go in there, and no one else had done this. And they talked about those two towers, and someone was shooting at the top of the towers, but they didn't go to the towers to see if someone could even get to the top of the towers. It's just all these things one after another, you know, which hampered a lot of people getting answers to the questions they were asking. And the families deserve to know, you know, what really happened. I mean, no one wants to be a part of a situation that they later find out was completely false or fabricated. You know, like the Alex Jones situations, you know, with Sandy Hook. You know, it as a parent or as a family member, as a parent of obviously a Sandy Hook victim or a family member of someone from Las Vegas, you don't want that premise to prevail that, you know, that a odd situation occurred that turns into the chief conspiracy theory that is not true.
Yeah.
But there are these situations that occur that we have to remember that a lot of times we are being told things and the conspiracy theory is no longer a theory. It actually becomes the fact. So, yeah. All this information has to exist together. You just have to weed through it to find out, you know, which ones are the answers that are correct for you under your particular situation. And, you know, a lot of times it goes one way or another, but the ones that we remember are the ones that, you know, down the road were actually true, you know? And, you know, more often than not, it involves the government. So, you know, we have to take that with a grain of salt, I guess, sometimes, depending on, you know, who's doing the reporting and what's being reported on.
I'd love to disagree with you on that fact, you know. But it's like we say on the show all the time, like, it's hard to hold them accountable because anytime they go before Congress, they pretty much hold their hand up and straight up lie. And it's one of those, what do you expect them to do? That's literally what they do.
Yeah. It's almost that's their MO when they go into something. It's, we're going to create a situation, or a situation has already been created that we didn't create, but we're going to allow it to fester and to turn into something bigger by either answering questions or not answering questions. Either way they go, they tend to want to add to the disinfo. And yet we have the Senate, you know, and the House that both have types of committees to prevent this very kind of thing, but they even in some ways perpetuate it. So you never know. You never know. It's very difficult. You know, but, you know, over time we will generally correct most of the issues that go south on us, you know, as far as getting the correct information. But, in the beginning throes of like the Las Vegas shooting, it was incredibly difficult with the amount that was coming out, to try to get to the meat of it. That's why I did the audio forensics as fast as I could, because I wanted to have that done before the FBI did their version of it. I was able to determine the moments of certain shots that were fired in certain locations and directions, and including, I was the only person that came up with the time of the actual shot where Paddock had, I don't know where this is going to go on your video, but unalived himself. And I kind of, that term just doesn't fit well with me.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was an important question for the attorneys, and I got that answer for them. And apparently the FBI had never been able to figure it out. So got it for them too, I guess. You know, there's so many, I guess a lot of times people don't realize how complex an investigation can become. All of the nuances and the little things that go along with it, especially when you're a one man band and you do your own audio forensics, you do your video forensics, and you're going up and you're actually retrieving physical evidence, which I shouldn't have been able to do. But, you know, to this day, I still have, you know, glass from that room, and I wanted to test it to determine if the, you know, if the windows had been shot out, if they'd been hammered out or what have you, and was able to do that. And that's kind of odd. It's not a common scenario where you can do it, but that happened. It's just so much. That investigation, it was 3 years of digging through thousands of hours of video and audio to determine what actually occurred.
And once again, it was almost 2 years before we had any kind of official report for anything. And even then, it was cursory at best with what we got. Again, with muddled timelines.
The report from Las Vegas
and
the report from Las Vegas Metro, their preliminary report, and I called it the FIT report because the FIT team is who did that part of the investigations. And normally you would think it would be the homicide division, but it ended up being a different division. But and the same thing with the FBI. The FBI didn't have their own report team out. They hired 25 different experts to go through the evidence that had been acquired. This basically same evidence that most of us had access to determine what had happened. But they didn't. It was one of the questions I asked Eric. I said, wouldn't it make sense that you would be, just like I'm doing it as a reporter / investigator / journalist, I'm trying to determine what actually occurred, and I would go to the closest person to Stephen to determine, how this occurred.
Yeah.
That would be his brother, Eric. And in doing so, that would make sense that the FBI would do the same thing, but they didn't. They only questioned him that one time, maybe a couple calls, follow up a little bit, but he was rather upset when he went there because there was a lot of things going wrong. So their meetings were not pleasant. We'll put it that way. Maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know. I'm proud of what I did. I was very satisfied with the answers that I was able to come up with, and it's nothing like going up to a family member or a survivor and them saying, "Hey, did this happen this way, or am I being told? What am I being told here?" And to be able to give them the answers that they're looking for, and that for me was probably the biggest thing. I can't take that experience away from anyone, and if I can make the situation better in some way to give people answers to what happens, then that's enough for me. I'm happy about that.
Well, and you guys, you and Ram definitely got some answers, and even as far as where the money from the relief fund went, things like that. This story goes so deep, and it has so many tendrils into so many different facets of the Las Vegas community. It's fascinating.
We could do a mini-series just on one aspect at a time.
Yeah, because there was the whole Vegas Strong movement and everything else, and that literally, the money from that just went away. They finally ended up getting a memorial put up, but it's not on the site.
It's the only one like that I've ever seen where a memorial of, especially of an event like this, is not only not at the site, it's nowhere near the site.
Yeah.
It's 9 miles away. It's literally downtown. It's right next to an adult, toy store, if you want to call it that.
I mean, but you're hard not to, you could put a baby food store in Vegas and it'd be next to an adult toy store, all right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I will say the memorial that's there is it was very touching, very heartwarming, and it was very well done as far as what they had to work with.
Yes.
But now that they have put that committee together to put the memorial where it basically should be, which is at that site, I appreciate the fact that they finally got around to doing that, because it was very frustrating as for a lot of people.
Yeah.
That they would go there and they'd go to where this event occurred and they would see nothing. You know, we put up the Melissa Ramirez memorial, which is, you know, at the site that where she actually passed, and you know, that was just a self-funded group of people. We all got together and made that happen. You know, there's a lot of frustrating events that occurred during this, trying to get people to do what we, you know, everyone would think would be the right thing, but it's Vegas. And that kind of made it different, because Vegas doesn't want a lot of attention towards event such as this. And I kind of understand it, but at the same time, it did happen. You have to address it. And it needs to be done in a way that's, you know, that works for the families involved and the survivors and so forth. It can't be just, some government committee making a decision. Well, let's put it 9 miles away, so, you know, out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. I'm glad that that's coming back to where it should be. So.
Absolutely. Me too. And Mike, I want to thank you as always for making time for me in your life, as well as making time for the show, but also for all the work that you've done for these victims, all the work that you do for victims all over the place, of human trafficking, all kinds of stuff. You are always out there working behind the scenes. I want to heartily thank you for coming on tonight and talking about this. I'm glad we finally got to do it, because it's something that it made me sad the last couple times where we didn't even get to touch it.
I had what I thought was food poisoning. It ended up being something else, but it was a rough few weeks, and it happened right over the 1 October weekend, and I was like, man, I need to be on this story. We had planned to do it, and I just couldn't. I couldn't even speak. I mean, I had no voice. I'm glad we got to do it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let everybody know where they can go to follow you, where they can go to keep up with everything that is Mike Turber and 5x5 News.
Probably your best way to keep current is going to be through X, formerly known as Twitter. Also YouTube, which I still am affected by the algorithm problems that they have. So, you know, I have to deal with that. But those two spots, and also on under my own name on TikTok, you can also see some of the stuff that I do there, which is Mike Turber, T-U-R-B-E-R. And that would be the best. But if anyone needs to reach out to me for any reason or what have you, each of those locations, just send me a DM. I do answer all my DMs, if they have a question about the shooting or any of the investigations I've done, then I'll be more than happy to talk to you.
Absolutely. And while you're online checking all that out, folks, make sure to stop on by IMDb. That's where you can see the trailer for Money Machine, Behind the Lies, the 1 October cover-up. You can find that on Apple TV, all kinds of platforms, and of course, don't forget to stop on by Curious Research. CuriousResearch.org is where you can find everything Curious Research. That's also where you can find links to Curious Realm, where you can like, follow, subscribe, and our videos page, where you can find all of the video platforms, all of the YouTube channels of our guests, including 5x5 and Mike Turber. Mike Turber, once again, thank you so much. Again, buddy, you take care. We will be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff, as usual. When we get back from this quick break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend, Ann Celine. We will be talking about the topic of belief and paranormal investigation, how that affects our investigations, how that affects the way we look at things, how that also affects the way that we experience things. We will be talking about belief and para-investigation with Ann Saleen right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying through that. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com, folks. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science make some of the best CBD products that I've found countrywide visiting dispensaries. They use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used, reused, combusted, and reused. Everything from the seeds, stems, buds, leaves, roots, every part is used, combusted, and reused to create an amazing spigeric product that is full of terpenes and all kinds of great compounds. Terpene profiles are listed on the website. Everything else, stop on by and check them out today. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. Our guest in this segment is our amazing and good friend, Ann Saleen. You can find all of her work not only at Medium.com, everything else, but also at AnnSaleen.com. She is a researcher into paranormal Freudian studies, things like that. And I wanted to have her on to discuss one of the topics that I hold near and dear to my heart, the idea of belief, especially when it comes to the paranormal. And you know, it's interesting. I say it on the show pretty regularly. I'm a former Catholic seminary, and I spent 1 year studying, a whole grand year, everybody, studying to be a Catholic seminarian. But there's something fascinating about the church that has always been, that still is, that a lot of people do not realize. And I'll start off right now with what I believe before we get into how belief affects paranormal and paranormal investigations. Growing up Roman Catholic, we said the Nicene Creed, the beginning of every Mass. We still say the Nicene Creed. It's a reformed Nicene Creed. As of a few, probably about 10 years ago now. It begins with, "We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, of all things seen and unseen." Like, that is the opening salvo of the Nicene Creed. The creator of all things seen and unseen. So by definition, by the very definition of the pillars of faith of the Catholic Church, and then it goes into Jesus Christ, the only Son, eternally begotten of the Father, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, one in being with the Father. Through him all things were made, for us men and for our salvation he came down from heaven, and so forth and so forth. But that first part, all things seen and unseen, like, that means we are hip deep in the paranormal as Catholics to begin with.
we
begin with the fact that the paranormal is real and our creator created that.
No, that's amazing.
And that's an interesting thing to lean on as a Catholic. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing. I mean, it allows for miracle. It allows for all kinds of things. And, but when you're talking specifically about the experience of paranormal, as we talk about all the time with you and with other people, it really is about that acceptance of experience, you know, right. And the ability to accept that you've had an experience, whether you can explain it or not through phenomenology, what have you, that's totally different. But like we say all the time, it doesn't remove the experience.
Right. Exactly. And first of all, I want to thank you so much for having me back on.
Always.
It's always an honor to be here. And, you know, I wasn't aware of the creed or that it said also the unseen. So that's amazing.
And I'll bring up the new Nicene Creed just so we are clear, folks, of all things visible and invisible. All right. So it didn't really change.
Right.
Even though they've reframed some of the phraseology of, you know, because now instead of, you know, being instead of the old Nicene Creed where it's, you know, eternally begotten of the Father, it's phrased differently, things like that. But it still says visible and invisible.
Right. Right. No, and that's incredible. And you know, the thing about belief is that, I mean, for me, in my belief, right, it affects absolutely every fabric of our lives.
Mm.
And I think, or believe, rather, that, you know, we talk about manifestation all the time. And so the different things that I think or feel or project are then brought back to me. And so I believe that our belief completely makes up our whole reality. You change one simple thought, you can change your entire reality. Now, when we go into the paranormal, and how do I want to open this up? I think we'll open it up with a harder topic, which is, you know, my personal experience that I know that I've shared before one time on here, where I was a child and I had a very traumatic experience. And I thought that, I mean, for most of my life, I believed that it could have been an alien encounter, that there was an alien in my room, that it touched my back. However, I would find out much later, a year or so ago, that it was not any kind of a paranormal event. It was a very real human event. However, the human mind is so adaptable, but also very fallible. So if we have the building blocks for a certain type of belief, and we have a traumatic experience, then our brain can pull from these different pools within our mind and put these puzzle pieces together to create this new memory. And then, but we have to have the building blocks of that particular belief before the brain will create that new memory.
Yeah. Yeah. This is quite literally the flaw that I have with, with Stephen Greer saying that the Betty and Barney Hill abduction episode was a case of my labs, where they were taken by a rogue Air Force unit and memories implanted.
Right.
To the fact that I actively had our friend Kathleen Martin on the show, the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, to refute his claims. Because there were things like, wait a minute, how about that star map that she came back with of a binary star system that we didn't know was binary at the time? How about, like, also just the fact of it's a biracial couple, you know, who wasn't trying to draw attention to themselves in the 1950s, a biracial couple. They weren't trying to, like, make news headlines about, hey, we were abducted by aliens. But you also have the issue of you have to have a trope that is acceptable to the mind to begin with to be able to implant it.
Exactly.
And when alien abduction wasn't really like a hot button topic, it wasn't in tabloid magazines or anything like that. So
right.
How are you going to implant a memory for a trope that isn't really out there?
Right. Right. Which is so important, to note.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this line of thinking, this line of talking can really help us get closer to the truth and to the things that are really genuine. I want to add in something else that I know that I've brought up before as well. This is the night myopia. So. Yeah. You know, of course, our eyes do not see anything like any kind of animal does. We have a very hard time seeing as soon as it gets dark outside. So then we become nearsighted and we're going to see shadows. That's just how it works because our eyes are focusing, refocusing, and just, you know, kind of like the camera lens, you know, and our brains don't understand what we're seeing. So if we're out in the woods and we're searching for Sasquatch or Dogman or whatever it is, then we have, so that's the seed of belief, right? Right there.
Yep.
We're out there searching for X. So then our eyes and our physiology starts doing something funny. And our brain goes, hey, what's going on? We have to adapt. We have to watch for, you know, things that could harm us. We're alert. Now we're, you know, and the mind is racing. So to survive, our brain needs to put those puzzle pieces together and create a story so that we don't break. So the adrenaline doesn't get too high so that, you know, whatever it is. So then all of a sudden those shapes that we think we're seeing are now the shape of whatever it is that we were out there to try to find. And then further, if we have the building blocks of, say, the more woo side of things, if that's an okay terminology, with the Sasquatch being abducted by aliens or mind speaking or what is that, like the teleporting and the invisibility, now we are going to be like, oh, when those shapes come in and out, right? When the shadows go in and out. Now we're going to say that it's teleporting, especially if we look over in a different area and now we're seeing another shadow, but that the shadow is the same thing over here now that it was over here.
Yeah.
It's just the way that our brain and eyes are talking to each other using the seeds of the belief that we've had.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely, because that is our greater frame of reference is what we hold to be true within the fabric of our reality. And that maybe goes beyond what we have even just been exposed to.
Right.
And you know, that brings us, of course, where we normally go with this, which is that dangerous point, especially with investigation of, you know, the cognitive dissonance and not allowing something that goes against what you believe. But that before we even get there, that idea of belief, once again, informs so much. It even informs whether or not you are out investigating.
Yes.
You know, and if you're willing to investigate. Because there are two different camps even with that, and that is the fact of you believe so much that you don't need to investigate, and those that believe so little that they investigate to want to find out more, possibly.
Right.
And yeah, that even in and of itself brings about a didactic of mentality.
Right. Yeah, you know, and that's the thing is, when we have an experience that maybe goes against our beliefs, it's interesting how we search for the answers to try to come up with, you know, we try to put it in the box even when it doesn't fit. And this is where I think things can become dangerous for the field. is when we're trying to force our beliefs onto a situation, a research topic, a, you know, an investigation or another person or even our audience. Well, it really does a disservice to ourselves and the field as a whole. However, our beliefs are so ingrained in us that to have a belief system, how do you say, deconstructed maybe, or poked at or questioned, it's like the fabric of the whole of the person is being questioned. It is this entire rejection dysphoria that is now taking over, and they feel threat. It's like you're being chased by a lion.
Yeah.
And so that's where it gets really, and here again, if I may.
Go ahead.
This is also why I advocate so much for therapy. It's not that nobody needs to just go because there's something wrong with them, but to know thyself.
That's right.
Yeah. To be able to really understand yourself, understand your triggers and all that kind of thing, because we don't want to bleed our wounds onto the field, onto our audience.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it, because there is the imposition of thought, you know, and it, you know, it comes into play in a lot of things. It comes into play. It's one of the reasons why I say not just personally all the time to people, but investigative wise to people,
right.
Stop having the conversation on the way to the table.
Yeah.
Go to that table as blank slate as possible. You know why you're going to the table. You know what the general conversation is going to be, but don't have the conversation
right.
in the car while you're sitting in traffic on the way to the meeting at Starbucks,
or
something like that. Because at that point, you are imposing upon that person what you think they're going to say, which means you're actively like mixing the mortar to help build the wall. Before you ever get there, because naturally after you hear that person respond in your head, you're going to salvo back. And then before you know it, there's an actual conversation going on.
Right.
That stymies you being able to just hear the person on the grounds that they are, because now you've put a voice into their head already and into their mouth. Then you've put emotion behind that voice, and you've put motivations behind that voice.
Yeah. You know? Well, think of it as well on the way to an investigation, be it for Sasquatch or a haunted house.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? That's especially because now you can really affect the outcome of the investigation. You can plant those seeds. I mean, we all have fear. We all have, I mean, no matter what, the fear of the unknown is at the root of everything. So whenever we're in a dark place, we're always going to have a level of fear because we can't see. We have senses that are, you know, dampened because of our environment. And so belief then, in regards to what you were saying, can completely affect and reroute, if you will, the outcome of an investigation before it's ever started.
Yeah. Yeah. And granted, folks, this is no admonition upon the people of faith. I'm a person of faith.
Yeah.
Big question, Anne, what do you believe? Like personally, spiritually, what do you believe?
Okay. So I grew up, so let's see, my whole history. So I was raised by my grandparents and my dad. And my grandparents came from a family that always went to the First Christian Church. So when I was born, I was dedicated to the First Christian Church in that little town. And then when we moved from there, and we moved to a different part of Oregon about 4 hours away, my grandparents and my dad didn't really attend church the same way that we that they did when Grandma's mom and dad were alive, because Grandma Lena was the matriarch of the family, and she had, you know, a love for the church, and she dedicated her time, and so everybody had to go. So when we moved and everything, they traveled all over. They were giving hearing tests and CPR, first aid for linemen and everything. So oh, wow. They were always on the road. And it wasn't until I was a teen and they retired from being on the road that we had a Methodist church in town. And so I went to the Methodist church with my grandfather. Now, I had friends, though, that had different beliefs. I had one really good friend who her father was the, I know they all have different names. I'm not sure if it's a pastor, preacher of the Mormon church.
Okay.
And then my neighbor, who I was always babysat by, she was, they were all Catholic. And so I also grew up with a Catholic background because I kind of lived at my neighbor's more than I lived at my house. And so I always, you know, partook in the services and, you know, when the nuns would come over and everything, I was included in the talks and everything. And so, I was very lucky. I think that I was very lucky to be able to grow up in multiple different belief systems. And that's where I learned to really ask. Like, I remember going to a Lutheran church, and I went, I talked to somebody who was of Jewish faith. And I love asking, what is it about your faith that inspires you, that makes you want to keep going, that really fills you with that faith? Everybody's answer is different, but that's the whole thing. When you can sit there and see the light in somebody's eyes and on their face when they talk about their faith, you know that that's the right faith for them. And that is a beautiful thing. And so, but I knew that I still needed to find that for me. Where is that? I don't know. So, as I got older and I started to go to a healing group when I was 15. So this is where we would go and we'd talk about all things esoteric and, you know, we'd do Reiki and talk about different beings from different star systems and everything. So okay. From the time I was 15 until I was in my late 20s, I loved the lessons that I learned there and hearing about the different spiritual aspects of life and you know, between there's Eastern spirituality and the yoga and meditation and I guess I just kind of became a quilt. And so there's just a lot of things over the course of my life, over the course of all the different belief systems that make sense. I think they're all beautiful in their own way.
Yeah.
From at least the ones that I've. So, I mean, and then I got lucky that I have a dad that believed in the paranormal. I mean, he had a very religious experience where he was down by the river, and I forget what he was going through in life at the time. We were still going to healing group. So he was down by the river and he was rock hounding, because I come from generations of rock hounders. And he stopped to sit on a rock and he saw somebody kind of off the corner of his eye. And he kind of walked down to the river by my dad. And this guy had long brown hair, and he was kind of wearing, you know, like some just loose, almost like yoga clothes kind of a thing, and some sandals. And my dad was, you know, like, oh, hi, how's it going? You know, and talked to him about rock hounding, and that's what he was there for. And the guy said, I think my dad asked him what brings you down here or something like that. I can't remember. Cause I was in high school at the time, and I remember my dad telling me, and my dad never cried ever. And he said, the man kind of looked up at the corner and he said, oh, I'm just staying with my friend Mary over there. And he was like, oh, that's cool, you know. And then my dad had gotten up and he bent over to, you know, something caught his eye in the river. He was going to look to see if it was an agate. And he stood up and the guy was gone. And to my father, through tears, he believed that he met Jesus, you know?
Yeah.
And that's his belief. And that was beautiful. And who am I to judge or say otherwise? Why should anybody judge and say otherwise? You know?
Yeah.
And it was a transformative moment. So I don't know. I don't know. That doesn't really answer. That doesn't really give you a good answer of what I believe, though. So I'm all over the place.
Yeah. And you know, it's one of those I've never personally ascribed to a whole didactic of heaven and hell.
Right.
I fully knew my Catholic roots. I knew the where my Catholicism came from,
right,
and its Judaic root. And I understood that had its roots in Zoroastrianism. Wow. And that is where monotheism got its real kickstart was Zoroastrianism. And, you know, that led me down all kinds of roads later in life, but I never ascribed to the hard heaven and hell, you know, and I always prayed extra for the people who had that hard black and white line, because yeah. I think there's a lot more to reality. There's a lot more to spirituality, and much like a black and white TV, feel free to turn that contrast knob all the way down and pull it off if you want to see a right. black and white image, because a black right. and white image without gray is almost indistinguishable. You can barely right. tell what the image actually is without yep. shades of gray. So that hard black and white, and the fact that they're, especially after studying world religion, things like that, I came to a much larger spiritual window. But for me, when it comes to belief and what I believe, I firmly believe in my God, mm-hmm. the creator, the prime mover of the universe.
Right.
And the fact that I take part in that frequency. And
right.
much like any bell, my frequency cannot be unrung.
Yeah.
That energy cannot be unmade. It can only transform. It can only change form. It can only right. vibrate higher or lower. And it is my decision as to what frequency I am vibrating on. When I vibrate to the different frequency enough, either high or low, that this coil and physicality is shed. And
oh,
it's
yeah.
only pure frequency. And whatever happens to that frequency, whether it's high or low vibration for the rest of eternity, is utterly up to me and where I'm resonating personally when that ends.
Right.
I don't think that's a fiery damnation. But I definitely right. think there's a different part of the spectrum, no different than infrared, ultraviolet, are two totally different vibrational levels,
right.
and opposite ends of the spectrum. So I think if you want to call that hell, okay. Cause sure, I guess it's removal from the higher frequency, no different than hell by the Christian doctrine is the removal of one from God's grace.
Right.
Right. Where you are now at a point where your sufficient grace is gone. You have,
right.
you have sacrificed what would be your sufficient grace, which is what always gives you right to salvation.
Right.
That kernel that you can never get rid of. And the day that you sacrifice that, then you're in a little piece of trouble because, well, yeah, you've now made it to where you can't save yourself, because that's right. always you doing that.
Yeah.
God's there, but it's you making that decision to do it.
And that's the hard part, is accountability.
It is. It is. But even, and to bring this back, the idea of this is a filter through which we all see the world is this realm of belief, you know? Right. And when you're approaching an investigation, you have to be willing to set that belief aside, I believe. Yes. And that even comes to point of, like, over my left shoulder is the rite of exorcism.
Right.
And there's a lot that it asks an exorcist to set aside in their preliminary investigation when it comes to faith. And it's like, let's don't go there. Let's don't touch that yet. Let's go into some physical things. Let's go into these, because it's like, have you exhausted medical means?
Right. Mental health and
examination,
everything.
Things like that. So, and once you've hit that wall, now, you know, do you start getting into things like the person having knowledge of things unknown, you know, things that they couldn't possibly know, that kind of stuff. That's where you start getting into the paranormal at that point, but, and the unseen as once again, is prefaced by the, by the pillars of Catholic faith.
Exactly. Well, and here's the other thing too, regardless of, I mean, okay, take an example. I remember seeing this one time. I went on an investigation and we all had EMF readers, right? Sure. So we're standing in a circle and we've got two. Yeah. I think two at the time EMF readers. And the question is asked, you know, turn it to red for yes, you know, green, no, whatever it was. And there was a response. And then the next question was, can you turn both of it, you know, both of these to, I think it's the red. I don't know. My dyslexia gets it mixed up.
No, it's red.
So, okay. So, can you turn both of these red? And then they both turned red. And then it was like, okay, can you turn the left one red and then the right one red? And it did that. But here's the thing. Did it, whatever it was, do it? Or was it the collective of how much these people or myself with them wanted that answer, wanted that proof? So did we do it ourselves somehow, manifest it, you know, whatever? I'm sure that there's probably a very scientific explanation with that in regards to, you know, the frequencies and all that kind of thing.
That is literally what quantum science is all about. And you know, what we bring up regularly at this point, I'm sure the audience is like, and remote viewing.
Yeah.
You know, cause that's what the paper written by Hal Puthoff so many years ago posited was, are scientists affecting their experiment when they go home and think about it?
Oh, right. And didn't we bring up, there was this one where if you, if you look at it, and this is like in science, like something about a tube, something about if you look at it, it won't happen. But if you're not looking at it, then there's evidence that it's like a particle, have you heard of that? Do you know what I mean?
Well, there's the idea that a particle has to know it's being observed in order to be observed.
Right.
The whole idea of how do you take a picture of an electron?
Right.
You know, you have to then predict the orbit of the electron and have a camera that's technically faster than the electron.
Right.
Which, good luck with that. So there's the whole quandary of, does the electron know it's being observed and slow down?
Right.
To have its picture taken.
Right.
And it's a valid thought experiment. You know, it's definitely one of those physics thought experiments that's out there. But that's also where a lot of science comes from, is that wandering. of things and that allowment. But that is the direct opposite and antithesis of belief.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I think the belief would really come more after the gathering of data and things like that. In science, it would be the hypothesis.
Right.
Would be the closest to belief. Like, I believe this is the case.
Right.
And from there, you experiment and you find out more. Things like that. So that would be the closest in investigation, would be that moment of hypothesis where it's right. Like, I've gathered enough data that I think this may be what we're looking at.
Right.
And even that though comes down to the point of what are you willing to put on the table? You know, we've been having a lot of conversation, not just online, but on the show about 3i Atlas. And the rampant belief that it's an alien mothership or an alien ship or something like that. And this is a hard belief from a lot of people. And they say, like, Avi Loeb believes this. Avi Loeb hypothesized hyperbolically the way science is supposed to. He's like, with its origin coming from the same area generally as the right. Wow signal in 72 or 77, but of the famous Wow signal, maybe there's a small percent of a chance, like a 2-3% chance that maybe it's alien technology. Well, he said that about Oumuamua, the first interstellar object.
Right.
One eye atlas. And no signal. No technology. You know, so 100% miss on that. He said possible alien technology, once again, with the sphericals that were recovered from the ocean floor. Jury's still out on that, so I'll give him 50%. So he's shooting a 50% right now, and at a 50%, it's a comet.
Right.
Is there a 2-3% chance? Sure, maybe, but that's exactly what he said. And with belief and faith in aliens and hope, things have been turned into something else. And it's fascinating to see how quickly and rampantly it takes over. It's fascinating to see that. And even I think, very litmus testy to allow it to continue, you know.
So
go ahead.
My question is, what would you say is the, how do I want to phrase it? Okay, so we have this need. We're showing this need for alien life form to find something, to find answers, to have. So what purpose does that need fill if aliens were to be found to be completely real and now they're a part of our reality? What need does that fill?
I think the need that fills is right at the same need that religion fills for so many, which is that connection to something greater than yourself, that pure involvement with something greater than yourself.
Right.
You know,
okay.
in that kind of way. I think that's a very human want.
Connection.
Since the time of Moon Dancer, the ape from 2001, man has looked at the sky. We've looked at the great beyond. We've wandered.
Right.
That's what separates us from other animals, things like that, is that A, the sense of wonder and awe, but B, which is one of the gifts of the spirit biblically, right. Oddly enough. But the idea that we want to believe in something else. And yeah, you have to wonder where that want comes from.
Right.
And what the source of that is. And when that want of belonging becomes so great, mm-hmm. so great. In my lifetime, I remember, a couple instances. I mean, number one, Waco. I'll never forget that. That happened just before I entered the seminary.
Right.
The incident at Mount Carmel happened. Yeah. Ruby Ridge. And on the heels of all that, within a couple few years was Hail Bop and,
oh, yeah.
and Heaven's Gate.
Yep.
It's something that I tell my wife all the time. I love this world. I love her. I love my son. I love all kinds of things, but I fully understand the heart of the true believer in that kind of way.
Right.
Where when you are so convicted to a belief that step that somebody else would go, whoa, wait a minute, that's way too far.
Right.
Is just a logical next step. And I say that because yes, I was willing to wear a collar for the rest of my life, man. I'm now married. Right. I have a kid, things like that. But there was a point in my life at the age of 17.
Right.
Where I made a commitment and a decision that I was ready to, and say whatever you want, folks, drink the Kool-Aid, what have you. But, I was ready to commit my life to my God and my belief.
Right.
At 17.
Yeah. I mean, call it crazy if you want.
I've counseled numerous other people that now wear the collar.
Right.
One of them works in vocations and things like that and brings other kids that are questioning into the world of finding out if they want to follow that spiritual path.
Right.
And it's great, but that's a different realm of belief. You know, that's believing things on a different scale.
Right.
So I understand when people believe things so hard that they are willing to let logic go by the wayside.
See, it's so sad because we actually, Ken ends up watching things on the anniversary of. So like we've watched the movies about Titanic in April, I think it was when it is. And this month, synchronistically enough, it's odd. And just yesterday, we found a brand new documentary on the Jonestown.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I think it was done by the National Geographic. It's on Hulu. Ooh. And the belief there and the testimonies from those people. And it's interesting because you mentioned drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
And I was actually going to bring it up before you said that. And so, but to see these people and the need and then when things started and everything and just how it got as far as it did. I mean, belief is the most powerful.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's the most powerful motivator in the world, quite literally. And it leads to horrible, horrifying tragedy.
Yeah.
As well as great conquering and beautiful things. And once again, this is not an admonition toward anybody of belief, toward anybody of faith. Please go every Wednesday, go every Thursday, go every day.
Sundays.
If that is what you are called to do, folks. However, we have to understand that these beliefs, these things that we hold near and dear and sacred to us, may also come into conflict with what we are investigating. It may keep us from looking at data in the right kind of way. And it may also send us down a road of investigation that doesn't need to be done.
Right. Right. No, that's true. And I mean, like you said, there's so many beautiful beliefs out there. And if it raises your spirit and it makes you feel peace, then, you know, by all means, but, you know and to accept that belief has two sides to it, you know, two sides to this sword. And to have the discipline to be able to know when to not allow it to completely blindfold you.
Yeah.
You know, and to know when to leave it at the door, so to speak, you know.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because all of 2 weeks ago, you get the invites for the show. Yeah. I know because your name's within a certain range of the alphabet. yes. whenever I hit the invite on my events on Facebook, it hits 500 people out of my friends list. All right. Yep. And one of those friends contacted me about a week or so ago. It was like, what's this about? And I'm like, well, you know, and it was, I guess, animal spirits or something like that was the topic.
Okay.
That, and then it was Chester Moore and the lost tribes.
Very cool. Yeah.
So I mentioned those topics and very, very right Christian Catholic lady. And she's like, well, you know, all I need is the Holy Spirit. It's like, okay. I guess never mind the unseen that's created once again, but okay.
Right.
Because once again, it's one of those, if right there in the belief, in the article of faith, it says things seen and unseen. It mentions the Holy Spirit later, most definitely, but it's that belief in the seen and unseen to begin with. So the idea that you aren't even open-minded to the conversation,
and the hard part is,
go ahead.
The hard part is here too. Sorry to jump in, but when you say the unseen, I think that some people could ascribe it to, well, of course, the unseen. You can't see the Holy Spirit. You can't see God's love. There are examples of it, sure, but those are examples. That's not the actual. So then it's taking and ascribing, you know, putting a belief within a belief and making, I mean, this is why you can go and have the same book. Right? You've got your Bible, but go to 10 different churches and have 10 different pastors read the exact same passage. Every one of them is going to say it different.
Yeah.
I saw that happen.
Yeah.
You know? So it's hard. So the unseen, if you have a certain belief there, they're not going to be able to necessarily compute that the unseen could mean the stuff from our world. They're going to ascribe it to, you know, you can't see God, you can't see Jesus, you can't see their love, you can't see the Holy Trinity, you can't see angels necessarily in their world.
Yep.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Hard.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just funny to me, though, to draw a line when it comes to unseen.
Yeah.
And to have such a hard, divisive line drawn where it's like, yeah, okay, no, not that unseen. That's not there. What is it?
Right.
But yeah. What? Okay.
Yeah.
And that was something that I brought up to a spiritual director many years ago, which was a big point of departure for me, which was, I've shared it with you on the show before, my shadow person experience, which I firmly believe was basically a primordial me, mm-hmm. wanting me to continue down the road of horrible activity in my life that I was doing to myself, not wanting right. to me to leave and be free of those self-imposed tortures. But when I right. mentioned that to my spiritual director at the time, a priest, he was like, "Well, you know, Chris, we don't really have a teaching on that." And I'm like, "Whoa, wait a minute." Because, you know, of course, the church doesn't have opinions. It doesn't think things. It teaches. That's what the catechism is the teachings of the church. And I'm like, "Wait a minute. You teach me that, you know, there are dark things stalking around each corner waiting for my soul. But right. when I tell you some dark thing reached out and grabbed me, you're like, hey, man, I'm at a loss. I don't know what to tell you." And that's a shark I don't know if I can jump.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know if I could jump that. Because that, like, you ask me to have faith and belief in the unseen. Right. But when given evidence of something unseen, you have no faith. So that's tough.
It is, because I remember growing up and, when I first started in the field, this is before 2015. Mm. So I was in healing group and everything. And I actually went to do house cleansings. I don't ever really talk about it, but, I would help with, clearing houses, properties, sure. as well as we had people come who said that they had attachments, or it's not like that traditional exorcism type stuff, but sure. you could, like, sometimes they used the word in regards to that. And so that's where I got my start. And I remember, hearing other people talking and everything. And I remember they would say that, we don't believe in ghosts here, or we don't, you know, X, Y, Z. And they're telling their children, you know, these things don't exist. But yet they believed in Jesus and angels and all these other things. And then sometimes, you know, I saw that a child might have had a, you know, an encounter, and they're extra scared now because their entire belief system, oh, this doesn't exist, this doesn't exist. And then all of a sudden they have an experience. And now it's more traumatic and it's more compacted because of the beliefs and everything. And, it doesn't make sense to me how you can say we believe in all of this, but all of this, if we were to believe in this, then we don't have faith. But it goes together, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. To me, they are inseparably congruent.
Yeah.
That's just how I see it. And I will sit and debate any show. Or any host about that fact. Gladly. But to me, the paranormal, and the Bible, things like that are absolutely congruent with each other. And once again, that idea of belief and faith and how does that inform our investigations? But B, affect them as well. And are we able to put belief and faith aside?
Right.
In that kind of way, when looking at and examining information and data, because we've got to be willing to, and we've got to be able to, you know, and there are a few topics that spring to mind, the whole, and don't get me wrong. Not saying Nephilim ain't a thing.
Right.
They're definitely spoken of in the big book, all kinds of things. However, the concept of disembodied demonic Nephilim, sure, I'll talk about it. But I don't know that everything is that, you know? And it's kind of like saying that every light you can't explain in the sky is a UFO, And it really comes down to the point of, wait a minute, if you're posting 20 videos a week on social media that you recorded in your backyard, well, yeah, odds on favorite period now is none of them are UFOs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's no longer a phenomena now.
Right.
It's a regular occurrence.
Right. You know, and that pushes it over into a totally different category.
Yeah.
One thing that I think would help when we're talking about putting belief aside to be able to look at things more objectively,
please,
is curiosity.
Mm.
Right. So if we can sit there and go, if I was able to take my belief out of this, I'm curious, what lens would I look through it now? What could I see with new eyes? Mm. And so instead of, because I think the big thing here is that when people take their belief, or they think about taking their belief out of something, fear is what takes place. And it's very unknown. Yeah. It's scary. So instead of going to fear, if we can then go to curiosity, I think that that could really help.
I think you're absolutely right there, because that is, I mean, that's where science goes. That's where we say it all the time on the show. We need more Magellans.
Yeah.
There was a guy who was like, give me a ship, give me a fleet of ships and some guys, and we're going to sail to that tiny thin line, and I'll tell you whether or not the world is round.
Yeah.
Because if it is, I'll come back.
Right.
And right? Come from the other direction.
Yeah.
And not,
that would be amazing.
Not return the same way I came.
Yeah.
But we've got to be willing to do that. And we've got to be willing to fearlessly cast aside what we know and hold to be true when we are investigating these things. Because otherwise, on either side, you become unyieldable, and it's either the side of, I will believe in nothing, and nothing is real, and nothing is like everything about all these things is fake and false and falsified, which I follow more than one person in those camps on more than one community,
right?
A couple of them right down the road from me in San Antonio, and at the same right, if you take it the opposite direction, and you will be sucked down the rabbit hole of any topic to the extreme. And that's where you start coming into things like Three-Eye Atlas and stuff like that. And I saw today somebody post about a famous channeler, who was like, you know, oh, it's an actual comet with alien technology embedded in it. Okay. I like the way you're exactly of the same frequency. That was not rehearsed, folks.
Yeah.
But literally, I'm like, okay, way to make a statement that is in no way, shape, or form testable or provable by any means.
Right.
So you're not wrong as the channeler.
Yeah.
At all or ever.
Exactly. Well, and that's the hard thing is that here again, belief isn't just about religion or, you know, whatever. We can have these personal beliefs that if we're wrong about something, then all of a sudden we are, you know, X, and then there's this domino effect.
I'd rather be wrong.
Yeah.
That's just me.
Well, no, exactly. Me too. Like, I can come on the podcast and I can say, well, I don't know, or I've been corrected before. And that's totally fine because, and I welcome that because I want to grow and I want to understand other people's points of view. And I also have a bad habit of jumping over things or talking too fast and forgetting stuff. And I feel so lucky to know people that will say, they'll kind of back up and be like, you know, to clarify and different stuff like that. And being able to have that kind of growth and humility and curiosity, though, and being willing to have that is so freeing, but you have to let go of the fear to be able to get to that point.
Yeah.
And some people never will, unfortunately, but we all have the ability to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it does take that openness. I'm not going to blow it because I've got the closing of the show coming up here in just a couple minutes where I'll say it anyway. But yeah, it is that idea of being willing to step outside of your box, being willing to step outside of your comfort zone, being willing to step outside of what you may feel you are expert in, and let new data and new information come in. Because without that, we can get lost, we can get mired down and become so myopic so fast. You know, one of the favorite things that I will say that I heard, and say what you want, folks, about the hearings that are going on in Congress about UFO, UAP disclosure, what have you, transparency, actually, not disclosure. But George Knapp was like, I'm sure by now, he's like, all these contractors are just doing the job that they are paid to do. Their job as a contractor is to work on things, reverse engineer things. Hey, here's a downed Russian jet. What technology can we back engineer and use in our jets? You know,
of course.
Now shut up about it.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, that's their job. So they're doing their job and they're doing it amazingly well. However, I'm sure at this point, and this is where you have to get with religion and belief and everything else, everybody, is I'm sure at this point they are looking for an off-ramp. I'm sure at this point they are looking for an off-ramp with which they can meet other people and collaborate. Because when you've got, doesn't matter the amazing technology, when it is locked inside of a vacuum.
Right.
For so long,
you
can't go anywhere with it. You need competition. You need healthy competition to make things grow. That's how we got rovers on the moon within a decade. Yeah. That's like competition is how we do that. Not locked away secrecy.
Right.
You know,
come in and everybody bring your knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you are so encamped behind your wall of belief and faith that you cannot step out into a broader light, into a broader spectrum of light, if you cannot share that data in a way that can cooperatively be looked at and researched, then we're hindering things. We aren't helping them. We aren't helping them with our closed mindset of belief at that point, you know? And we're all supposed to be here as researchers to help these communities, not hinder them. So, have your personal beliefs, hold them strong, but do not let them
interfere hinder and with block or
hinder
and
work.
Hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the caveat to go out on here is that idea of, once again, hold what you believe dear to you, but don't let it cloud your judgment when it comes to research. So,
and definitely don't weaponize it.
Yes. Yes. That as well. And thank you so much for your time. It's always great breaking topics like this down with you. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go, to find your Medium, where they can go to find your website, where they can go to find all things Ann Celine. I know you have new works coming out.
I do.
All kinds of things. So let everybody know.
Yes. So I'm republishing my first book. Yay. And that I will announce about on my Facebook page, which you can find me under just Ann Celine. And then also my website is annceline.com. And that right from there is where you can find my Medium, because it's, I think, on the very front page that there's, it uploads my different blogs that I write. So, and again, you know, medium.com/@entomology. And yeah, I mean, I'm most active on Facebook. So find me there, send me a message. And yeah, I hope to connect. This has been absolutely incredible.
Absolutely. It's always great having you on, and I always love our conversations. Once again, we really do go places with it. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from Ann Selene, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find the videos channel, which has all of the embedded channels of our guests and friends, people like King Gerhard, all kinds of folks. That is also where you can find your link to Curious Research. CuriousResearch.org is our endeavor to bring the worlds of science and paranormal research together. And in that spirit, we have an amazing free tools section, curiousresearch.org/tools, all kinds of great free online tools that you can use for, you know, photography analysis, video analysis, all kinds of things. So stop on by, check that out. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds tonight, everybody. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.